Desmond Wilkie reel two. I think you've got one or two more things that you'd like to say about your period on HMS Kent.
One of the things about the job of a Fleet Air Arm officer on a cruiser was that you were expected to take your share of watchkeeping duties, particularly in harbour. And I learned how to keep an anchor watch, that is to make sure the ship wasn't dragging her anchor in port, and to arrange all the boat services, pick up stores and everything. And this was very useful experience, although I'll tell you later, in an aircraft carrier, it was a disadvantage too, to have been a watchkeeping officer because, well, I'll tell you later. The county-class cruisers, Kent, Cumberland, were all built for the China station, and they had a very high freeboard, and they were very, very wet and very, very lively in the sea. And really, they were the last boats you wanted to be on for up in the Arctic. Fortunately, I'm a good sailor. I've only ever been seasick once, and that was the first time across the Atlantic on the way to Trinidad. And ever after that, I was never seasick. So, but they are very, very lively ships. Really, as I said, to be on a Warus, on a ship on up in the Arctic, really wasn't adding very much to the capabilities of the ship anyway. And had we done an operation, say we'd been firing at one of the big cruisers, it would have been a one-off operation, and we then would have had to look after ourselves.
Was it an efficient ship?
Kent? Yes, it was a good ship. Yes, it was an efficient ship. It had a first-class gunnery officer, a chap called Keyes, who eventually ended up as the commandant of an outward bound school somewhere. But he was an absolutely first-class man. And I didn't think a lot to... There was an MP on board, MP for Worcester, and he was a... I didn't like him very much. He wasn't very friendly to... You know, he regarded me as the bottom of the line, which I was. I mean, a temporary acting sub-lieutenant or MVR, you can't get lower than that, can you? But anyway, I left Kent in August 1941... 42. And I then... Oh, by the way, the reason why I left Kent is I was in an aircraft accident. When we came back to Scarpa Flow from Hatstone Airport, we had to... The way to identify yourself as a friendly aeroplane was you had to go to a certain rock, fly around it three times, and then go to your ship. But they never pulled any barrage balloons down. So the navigator stood up in the Warus looking for balloon cables. These balloon cables were tied to the anti-submarine nets. So you really just had to look out for the cable. And it was very dodgy. Now, we'd had our wheels off at sea. You take the wheels off a Warus at sea because you don't need your wheels anyway. But we put them back on to fly to Hatstone. And coming back in, I was standing with my head up through the door of the Warus, looking out for cables. And the pilot failed to hear the hooter, which warned him his wheels were down, and we landed on the sea with the wheels down. I received that scar there and was washed out of the back of the plane, and my pilot, who had a solid partition behind him, was drowned. And this was very sad. Paddy Osserkamp was drowned. The air gunner also was washed out of the back. We all tried very hard to reach him, but the plane had sunk about... It was down, only the tail was showing, and we secured it, and I went in and somebody else went in to try and get him out, but we couldn't get him out at all, and that was very sad. And that was in fact the last flight I did from HMS Kent. I was taken off to hospital and Kent sailed. All I had was a gash there and a gash in my chin and a gash in my forehead, I think.
The gash is on your throat.
Yeah.
What was it like operating from Hatstone, apart from that hazard you just talked about?
Oh, well, it was only our headquarters. It was a place we went ashore to see all the planes, all the Waruses on the cruisers were in a squadron called 700 Squadron. And the CO of 700 Squadron was based at Hatstone. So when we were in harbour, we flew ashore and did some training exercises and received the latest news on armaments and how to attack a submarine. You know, there were certain tips on how to mount the best attack on a submarine with depth charges. It was a case of, as soon as you saw the submarine, you pressed your stopwatch. And then you flew straight to the submarine, and when you saw the direction he was going. You were allowed so many seconds per second that you had coming up to the wash before you dropped your the depth charges. That was the kind of things that we went ashore for, exercises and briefing.
What did the crew of a walrus consist of?
There was a pilot, an air gunner, and myself. The air gunner was also a telegraphist as well. The one I had was a man called Lofty Hart, who'd been a telegraphist air gunner for 20 years. He was very, very competent, very, very good.
So you had to recuperate from your injury?
Yeah, it wasn't long. I was sent on leave, and I was only about a fortnight. And then I was appointed to the Royal Naval Aircraft Repair Yard at Wingfield, Cape Town, as a pool observer, so that when if there were any casualties in Illustrious or the other carriers that were out in the Indian Ocean, I would be drafted in to fill the vacancy. Now, RNAR Wingfield, I was there from August until October, and our duties, we tried to keep in practice. I did a couple of nav exercises, I see, but mainly we were used for drogue towing, so that ships like the Sirius and the Phoebe and other cruisers could practice anti-aircraft fire. Now, you only had a towing length of something like 2,000 metres, and you always had the feeling that you weren't very safe if the gunners got it wrong, that they'd start firing at you instead of the drogue. And as I once wrote in a letter, I would far, if I'm going to be shot down, I'd rather be shot down by the enemy than our own ships. So I volunteered as soon as I could to fill the next vacancy in a carrier. And in fact, I was drafted to HMS Illustrious in October 42.
What were your relations with the South Africans like?
Oh, they were wonderful. They were very, very hospitable. Very, very hospitable. It was a curious country to go to because, of course, they had these terribly rigid rules about how you treated, where you went, and how you treated backs and things. And, you know, it didn't really go down very well that you had to treat people in that way. But that was the way they lived. While you might have disapproved of it, you kept to the rules, and they were very, very hospitable to us. Very, very hospitable.
What form did that take?
Oh, inviting you out for meals.
Is this in Natal?
This was in Cape Town. And then I went from Cape Town to Durban and joined HMS Illustrious in Durban.
What impression did Illustrious make on you when you joined?
Oh, terrific. It was a different world. Terrifically efficient ship. You see, Illustrious was going to have Lord Louis Mountbatten as captain, and he handpicked most of the heads of departments, the ship's officers. So they were really like the gunnery officer, the torpedo officer. They were all at the top of their profession. The squadrons on board were really first-class squadrons. And all in all, you know, it was another world to me. Here was the world where the Fleet Air Arm was the dominant partner, rather than on a Warus where you were a spare file. And this was, you know, the life that eventually I liked and stuck to. There are a couple of actors on the Illustrious. Michael Hordern was an officer in Illustrious. And another one who had a twin brother who was a Commodore, but he was an actor too, and I don't know if I can remember his name. But it was a first-class efficient ship. Really was.
Were you friends with Michael Hordern?
Well, I mean, it's an irrelevant story, but I knew him, and I used to talk to him occasionally. And after the war, in about 1948, I was going down to the pub at Stratford. I was back of the post office, and I was working in from Birmingham. I was in Stratford-on-Avon. And walking down, I saw that Michael Hordern was in the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre. So I said to the chap I was with, you know, I might know Mike Hordern. You know, we served in Illustrious together. And I don't know whether you know Stratford, but there's a pub there called the Black Swan, known as the Dirty Duck. And I went in there, and there at the bar was Mike Hordern. And I thought, this is put up or shut up time, you see. So I said, oh, hello, Mike. remember you from illustrious days. And he, fortunately, he reacted as though he'd known me from old. Hello, old chap, nice to see you. And so my honour was preserved, but I really had presumed a bit because I didn't know him that well.
He was senior to you, was he?
Oh, yeah, he was senior lieutenant. I was a sub-lieutenant. I flew on Illustrious. I only did one deck landing in Illustrious, and that was a man called Lieutenant Swain and the Swordfish. Now, Lieutenant Swain was one of the officers who carried out the raid on the in Taranto. He was a Taranto man. So that was a great thrill and a great honour to fly with a Taranto man. You know, they were the top of the profession. But unfortunately, Illustrious was sent back for refit, and we were put ashore in Mombasa, an aerodrome called Port Reitz, to train. We were in Fulmers, actually, a Fulmer squadron it was, to train up for another carrier to come out, because at the time, I think there was a plan to reinvade Sumatra. And so we were put ashore there. And we worked very, very hard working up. Our squadron of six Fulmers were combined with another squadron of six Fulmers to make a full squadron. And we trained very, very hard in army cooperation, but mainly in long-range reconnaissance. Any ship that came into Mombasa, we flew out and did night searches and day searches and picked them up and reported their positions. And we really learned our trade as a long-range reconnaissance plane very, 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 very hard. I mean, got a number of Search and Shadow, Hawkins and Empress of Russia, Search and Shadow, Revenge and two destroyers, Search and Shadow, Mauritius. And they were all very good for learning how to do this job, which was the job of a long-range fighter, reconnaissance plane. And then we did a lot of work with the 6th East African Division on army cooperation.
What did that consist of?
All going out, sending messages to patrols, searching for them in the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro. We were up at a place called Moshi, and we worked very hard there learning what the job of army cooperation was.
Was that work popular?
Well, yes, you know, it was new to us. We learned a new trade, army cooperation, and you know, we the point is, it kept us busy and it was interesting.
Which division was it?
It was 803 Squadron, this was.
Which division of the army were you cooperating with?
6th East Africa Division. There was mainly the King's African Rifles. There were about three battalions of King's African Rifles. And they later went to Burma.
What was the Fulmer like to fly in as compared with the
Walrus? It was very slow. Oh, it was faster than the Walrus. Walrus cruised at about 75 knots. The Fulmer cruised at 130. It had a lot of petrol on board. You could stay up in a Fulmer with the long-range belly tank for, what's the longest I did? About 6 hours, I think. About 6 hours. But it wasn't a fighter. And as they found when they tried to oppose the Japs at Colombo with Fulmers, you know, they were easy meat for the Zeros to shoot down. But on the other hand, it would have made a good long-range reconnaissance plane. And it was easy to navigate and easy to fly. But it wasn't a first-class plane. Its speed was very deficient.
Did you do any sea rescues of people who'd been torpedoed?
No. Actually, after the Japs withdrew from Colombo, they never ventured into the Indian Ocean again because, of course, they lost all the carriers that did the attacks on Colombo at Midway. And they didn't put many submarines out in the Indian Ocean. After we'd invaded Mauritius, there really was no base for them. There was no place they could hide away and hang out.
Madagascar?
In Madagascar, I mean. Not Mauritius, Madagascar. So take that back. Madagascar. So really there was... In fact, that's why Madagascar was invaded. So the Japs shouldn't form an agreement with the Vichy French and use it as basis for their submarines.
How did you like it being based in East Africa?
Oh, it was. I mean, East Africa's a lovely place. We had one fortnight's leave up to Nairobi, and we hired a car and drove through Uganda over to Rwanda and the mountains of the moon. And it was all very peaceful. It's hard to believe that that beautiful country is now sort of riven with strife. In fact, we have a feeling that we stopped on that holiday at the Imperial Hotel at Kampala, and by looking at the dates, Idi Amin was probably a page at that time. No, I don't know that whether that's true or not, but it's an interesting thought that we might have seen Idi Amin at that time as a youngster.
I think he later became a sergeant in the KAR.
That's right, yeah, an askari. Yeah. So East Africa was very nice. We had a lot of aerodromes there, you know, because when we withdrew from Colombo, they built aerodromes at Tanga, Moshi, a horrible place called Mackinnon Road, where the fighters were sent to, where the only thing to do was go down in the evening to the station to watch the night train from Mombasa to Mombasa to Nairobi go through. It really was the most dreadful place. But there was all, you know, this was the base for the East Indies fleet at the time, although there wasn't much of an East Indies fleet left once they withdrew the carriers, Illustrious. There were just a few old cruisers, and that was all. But the Japs, of course, no longer posed a threat to Ceylon.
And how did your career then develop?
Well, now, in August 43, again, I slipped off the wing of a plane in a tropical storm and fractured my ankle. In August 43, in fact, the 2nd of August 43, during a tropical storm, getting out of my plane, I slipped off the wing of the former and fell on the side of my foot and fractured my ankle. I had that set, and I was sent down to Durban to have some orthopedic work done on me. And then I came home, and I got home in January 1944.
What was your job to be then?
Well, I was appointed back to 700 Squadron to HMS Rodney. And she was in Rosyth, and for a month I did training with a new pilot called Sub-Lieutenant Campbell. I knew most of what there was to know about the war, so really it was a bit marking time, and I wasn't very happy about it because there was no job to be done on HMS Rodney. The Spitfires had taken, for D-Day, the Spitfires took over spotting for the fall of Shot. There was really no job for a warrus on Rodney. So in the end, in February 44, they took the catapult off Rodney, and I was sent home to wait another posting. And then I got the posting I really did want, which was to a Firefly Squadron. That was on the 13th of April 1944, and believe it or not, I was so senior by then, losses had been such that I was appointed a senior navigator, which really was. I mean, it was a great job. Great crowd of chaps, wonderful plane, absolutely first-class CO called Major Cheeseman. And we went up to Hatton to work up, train with this new plane, preparatory to joining Indefatigable, a new carrier. And those were very, very exciting days. We knew we had a job to do. We knew we had a good plane, and all we wanted to do was get as good as we could. We were the very first Firefly Squadron.
What were these planes like?
Oh, they were quite quick. They cruised at 200 knots, a top speed of about 280. They had four cannon. About 6 months after I joined the squadron, they were fitted up to fire rockets as well. So they could perform a job as a ground attack, long-range reconnaissance. They had a role, and a role which they could perform, I think, very efficiently. They weren't really a fast fighter, but on the other hand, they packed quite a clout. They could go at a fair speed, but above all, they were a very, very good, well-designed plane. The Barracuda, you know, people didn't like at all because the wings didn't stay on very often. But the Firefly never gave us a moment's concern. It's a great plane. They had a lot of trouble with the Barracudas. They had some design faults, which were... they eventually cured most of them, but if you dive too fast in a Barracuda, the rivets began to pop. But anyway, we worked up and did our training, navexes, air firing, dummy deck landings, night navigation exercises.
This was where?
In Hatstone. And then eventually, in May 1944, we embarked on HMS Indefatigable.
Why were you such an admirer of Major Cheeseman?
Well, it wasn't an easy job. We had 30 officers, all youngsters. None of them were over 22. Being an aircrew on a carrier is, there are a lot of you, and it can be quite boring unless you really need to have a firm but kindly hand who understands people, and Cheese was absolutely first class. And we were a very good squadron. We all had an immense loyalty to him, and I suppose we were little trouble. You know, we kept ourselves to ourselves. We had a terrific esprit de corps. We did a lot of training, and we had some first-class officers, first-class pilots, first-class navigators. And, you know, we just felt we were good. And we were, I think. We were.
And the squadron was called 1770?
1770, that's right. We were the very first Firefly squadron. Now, we joined in DeFat in May, and we then started training for an operation against the Tirpitz in North Norway. The ship itself it was a new ship. It was a good ship, too. We had some good ship's officers there. The commander, a man called Commander Whitfield, was very, very good indeed. Commanders could get quite shirty with their crew because we were undisciplined. We were forever playing practical jokes on each other, and, you know, we were lively, we were young. We had a low threshold of boredom. And so, you know, young aircrew could make a lot of trouble for the commander. Commander Whitfield understood all this. And, you know, he came down hard on people who went over the top, but he wasn't pernickety. And it was very good.
And were these practical jokes dangerous?
Not really. They were silly games that were played, you know. I suppose they were, really. Sometimes, you know, there were rugby games in the wardroom and going around the wardroom without touching the floor. And there were all kinds. And we used to play a lot of deck hockey. A lot of deck hockey. This was with a rope gunnet and hockey sticks. And there was a very, very competitive league. And, you know, every squadron wanted to be top of the deck hockey league. And it got pretty rough. You know, I know one chap who had about 10 stitches. I mean, it made the rugby match against South Africa recently sort of kid stuff. Because, you know, I know one chap who had sort of about 10 stitches in his forehead where somebody sort of lifted his hockey stick a bit high and a bit hard. But this was us, you see. This was what being young was about, I suppose.
But the practical jokes didn't extend to the flying.
Oh, God, no. No, no, no. Once you got on the plane, you were very, very disciplined. Very disciplined. Oh, no. On the other hand, we had to push ourselves to the limit. I mean, we had planes that we were supposed to fly very low when we were shadowing so that we weren't picked up by the ship's radar. And occasionally a plane would dip his air screw in the water and break 3 inches off it, and as we were short of air screws, this was a heinous crime. But Firefly wasn't a difficult plane to land on. We didn't really. I mean, Cheeseman was such an expert pilot. We never picked up anything more than the second wire, whereas we never floated over. Whereas if you picked up the fourth wire, you invariably hit the barrier and wrote your air screw off. But Cheese was very good, and most of our pilots were very good too.
Can you explain the arrangement of wires for those who don't know?
Yeah, well, there were two wires behind the lift, four wires in front of the lift, and then you had two barriers. So that if the plane was floating and likely to hit the planes that were parked on the bow of the ship, the barriers would stop it. And invariably they would break the air screw and possibly do some damage to the wings. Now, it was the job of the batsman and the pilot to bring the plane down to catch his hook on the second wire, because that was safe. If you hit the third wire, you were probably all right if there was a good wind over the deck. The fourth, fifth, and sixth wires were a bit dangerous. So But our pilots were very good. We had very little damage to the planes due to accidents on the deck, whereas the Spitfire was a devil to land on, and they were forever breaking the undercarriage.
Now, you were telling me that you were preparing for the Tirpitz attack.
The Tirpitz attack.
Can you take me through that in detail?
Yes. Now, they found in Scotland a fjord which looked like where the Tirpitz was anchored. And they anchored a cruiser there. I think it was the Cumberland. I wouldn't be sure. I think it was in one of the county-class cruisers. And for days on end, we would fly and form up into the main strike force, which is the Barracudas, the Fireflies, which were front cover, and go in first to strafe the anti-aircraft guns and make them keep their heads down, and the Spitfires, and I think we had Hellcats as well, or Wildcats, which were top cover to, in case any fighters came in to intervene. And we learned how to form up, which is a difficult job when you're all taking off a carrier, how to reach the right operational height, how to fly in, how to do the attack. And we attacked this I'm trying to find one of the dates. We did about two or three attacks, dummy attacks on this cruiser. And then in July, we set off to attack the Tirpitz in Carr Fjord.
What do you remember about it?
Well, it was very exciting. It was a very exciting day. Here we were, we've been training for years, and we were going to do the job we've been training for. And morale was very, very high. We knew that the Tirpitz would put out a smoke screen to try and cover her. She'd already been attacked by the Fleet Air Arm about 6 months before. A man called Baker Faulkner had commanded the attack. But she'd been repaired, and we were going in to dive bomb her. The Barracudas were going to dive bomb her again with 1,600-pound bombs to try and put her out of action for a further period. And we flew in low, we climbed to about 4,000 feet as soon as we'd been recognised, because there was, on the coast of Norway, there were a series of radar stations, flew up, climbed to about 7,000 feet, and then we went in first, the Fireflies went in first. We had four cannon, which had quite a weight of attack, and we attacked the anti-aircraft